Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll talk with an infectious disease expert and get a status update on COVID, the flu, and measles, a change in federal vaccine policy, and a reduction in the number of people getting vaccines is a concern to many in the medical community. We're seeing a lot of extreme weather in the Midwest. It's creating a lot of problems for farmers. We'll have details. An education nonprofit is trying to recruit more people into the classroom, including those willing to leave another profession. A boxing great picked an unlikely spot for his final resting place, we'll explain. And this week in Illinois history remembers the first train to cross the Mississippi River, making its maiden trip. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Extreme weather events are happening more often, and that has been especially true in the Midwest this spring. From sudden temperature swings to heavy storms to floods, the events can have serious consequences for farmers. Emma George Griffin reports.
At Hart's Pasture Farm in northern Michigan, the remnants of a record-breaking ice storm are everywhere.
You can see like the tops of the trees that are broken off.
Amanda Walter owns the 15-acre potato and goat farm deep in these woods.
And you can see ones that are dangling, and those are called widowmakers. I would be the widow in that scenario.
The ice storm in March of last year left a thick, icy glaze on trees, homes, and power lines. Some northern Michigan residents were left without power for weeks. And for farmers like Walter, removing debris cut into the planting season.
Every day of cleanup is just ticking in your head. You know, that's one more day that we're not planting potatoes.
Walter says it will take a lifetime to clean everything up. In March, the state got hit by another ice storm and blizzard that dumped up to 4 feet of snow in some areas. This month, as the snow melted and heavy rains fell, Michigan has faced serious flooding. Brad Rippey, a meteorologist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, says weather events like these are becoming more common and more intense as the climate changes.
That's definitely another trend we have seen. There's a couple of reasons. A warmer climate, that can lead to more water vapor.
Rippey says the more water vapor the atmosphere holds, the heavier rain, ice, and snowstorms are becoming. In the Great Plains, heavier rainfall in warm months creates lots of vegetation. With warmer, drier winters, that vegetation dries out, making more fuel for wildfires. Larry Burgess is a rancher in western Nebraska. This spring, he experienced that firsthand.
And the horizon, as far as you could see, was just glowing pink, and I knew that was fire. But the wind was out of the west, so we were all right for the time being. But the wind was forecasted to turn to the south, and I knew we'd be in trouble then.
Burgess says 2,500 acres of his pasture land burned in the fire. Now he's moving some of his cattle to other properties to protect the land as it recovers.
When that grass does green up, those cows just really go after it, and they'll just trample it and do more damage than the fire did.
Oklahoma state climatologist Gary McManus says exceptionally warm temperatures over the winter help drive these massive fires.
Oklahoma and other parts of the southern plains have had not only their warmest winter on record, and those date back all the way back to 1895 when records began, but Oklahoma also had its warmest February on record.
In Texas, peach farmers are trying to adapt to the drier and warmer than normal conditions. Eckhart Orchards in central Texas uses a drip irrigation system to water their peach trees. Orchard owner Diane Eckhart says they started irrigating when stretches between rainfall grew too long.
It helps. It certainly does not replace rainfall, but it certainly helps. And that's one of the biggest significant changes I've seen in my lifetime.
Eckhart says the orchard traditionally avoided using irrigation because of the expense, but now she says they have no choice. Between drought and wild temperature swings, growing peaches in Texas is getting harder to do, but the Eckhart family is figuring it out as they go.
Even with the challenges that we may face with our changing weather, it is still a wonderful life, and we love it. Definitely there are days that we want to quit, but we learn how to adapt.
Eckhart says her family will keep growing peaches in Central Texas as long as they can. I'm Emma George Griffin, Harvest Public Media.
Employees at the Rock Island Arsenal are working without union contracts. That's after the Army announced it's canceling their collective bargaining agreement. Brady Johnson with WVIK has more.
WVIK spoke to an American Federation of Government Employees representative who requested anonymity to discuss Army policy with the media. They say the federal government is canceling the Army's union contracts across the board and will follow at 40 other governmental agencies. They state the AFGE will respond in court and the 200,000-plus members will outlast the Trump administration. In a joint statement, Quad City Area Congress members Eric Sorensen and Marionette Miller Meeks say employees have a right to join a union and negotiate fair wages. They are asking the Department of Defense to reconsider the action. Army spokesman Major Travis Shaw responded with a statement. This action is being taken to implement Executive Order 14251, signed by the President on March 27, 2025. The Department of War's directed all components to execute these changes on April 9th, and the Army is complying with that directive to ensure our labor relation policies are consistent with our national security mission, end quote. This comes after the Army announced a realignment process last month to fill vacancies at the arsenal and other installations. In response to a letter from Congresswoman Miller Meeks in late March, the Army Secretary's office claims the initiative, Making Employees Surplus, is intended to determine who can fill open positions and to pull employees from other areas to fill vacancies at the arsenal. The letter states this is affecting 74 employees there. However, the AFGE representative states that the number is far higher and impacting over 150 people. The Army claims this is to avoid reduction in force measures, but states that if employees decline new positions, they will be offered early retirement or severance pay pending appeals. The AFGE representative says this maneuver is to circumvent the organization heads from determining their own budgets and personnel. The letter mentions the use of Palantir in matching personnel to positions, a company that uses data analytics that's in controversy for assisting Immigration and Customs Enforcement in locating people for deportation, as well as its use in the conflicts in Ukraine and Palestine. I'm Brady Johnson.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargill. On April 22, 1856, crowds cheered and bands played in Rock Island, Illinois and Davenport, Iowa, as a train chugged across the very first bridge to span the Mississippi River. The bridge connected the Chicago and Rock Island Railroad in Illinois and the Mississippi and Missouri Railroad in Iowa. But construction of the Rock Island Bridge almost didn't happen, and even after its historic opening, opponents tried to sue the bridge out of existence. At the heart of the bridge battle were steamboats, slavery, and two men who would later stand on opposite sides of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis. Secretary of War Jefferson Davis wanted to see the Transcontinental Railroad cross the Mississippi by way of a southern route, which would provide the South with more trade, travel, profit, and, of course, access to new slave states west of the Mississippi. Despite his best efforts, he failed to derail the project. Steamboat businesses filed multiple lawsuits, arguing that the bridge damaged their industry's profits and disrupted river routes. For one trial, the railroad brought in skilled railroad attorney Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln successfully argued that the bridge did not impede river traffic and that railroad bridges were necessary to carry the country forward. The case propelled Lincoln onto the national stage and forever settled an issue that today we take for granted, the right to build bridges across navigable streams. I'm Clint Cargill, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
Many people enjoy the beautiful landscape of western Iowa. The professional boxer George Foreman loved it so much, he was buried there, even though he had no ties to the area. Sheila Brummer with Iowa Public Radio reports.
Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott delivered a surprise hook during a news conference by announcing a boxing champion was laid to rest at local Logan Park Cemetery.
Growing up, George Foreman was certainly a hero of a lot of ours, and he represented the United States as well as anybody.
Foreman's family joined the mayor. George Foreman Jr. says his father felt at peace when he visited the area more than 40 years ago.
And he would always talk about the hills in Iowa. He would tell different stories about it, but never the city. It was just Iowa. There's a saying called Iowa Nice. Have you heard that? Iowa Nice. It was like he was nice, but he wasn't from Iowa, but this all makes sense now.
George Foreman died last year at the age of 76. His family returned to Sioux City a year after his burial to see their father's monument. They plan to visit often. I'm Sheila Brummer, IPR News.
A nonprofit aims to help Illinois State University and other teaching colleges in Illinois address the teacher shortage by recruiting more educators from other professions. Grow Your Own Illinois hosted a recruiting event at the campus to find prospective educators for ISU and more than 20 colleges and universities across the state. The recruitment director, Herman Reeves, says the group is targeting those considering a career change and non-traditional students through its We See the Teacher in You campaign. He talked with Eric Stock.
The campaign is focused on the target audience of career changers, paraprofessionals, and school-adjacent individuals. And career changers, pretty wide category. Anybody who's looking for an opportunity who might be interested in working with children, who might be interested in education. Paraprofessionals are folks who are already in the classroom, so they're doing the work. That's a key target audience for us across the state. We think there's a real opportunity to help a lot of paraprofessionals take the next step to licensure. And then that last audience is school adjacent. That sort of captures anybody around the school who are working with kids, from tutor to mentors to coaches who might be interested in taking the step to become a licensed teacher.
So they sound like the most likely candidates for a second career in education. But how wide of a net are you casting in terms of the types of careers where they'd be coming from?
You know, it's a good question because we don't have an answer. I think we have ideas around where and who might be interested, but we're learning. What we do know is our focus as an organization is non-traditional students. And what we mean by that is we aren't necessarily focused on students who come directly from high school into college. We're more interested in students who may have taken some time off between older students, students who have careers and jobs. These non-traditional students are our key focus within that target audience, and that's who all of our programs focus on.
How does this campaign address the lack of diversity among teachers?
Part of the shortage is a shortage in teachers who look like the students that they're teaching. And this campaign is about increasing the diversity in the teacher workforce in Illinois, both through racial diversity, but also underrepresented communities in general. We want to make sure that we're providing in this campaign an invitation to those who have not been invited before. We are looking to go into communities where folks exist that may not have been given that invite to become a teacher and educator to join the profession.
Do you think that lack of a prior invitation is going to make up the difference?
It's the start. The conversation that we have, we know that you can't get to a license if you've never been asked. So we start by asking the question, and we've invested money into asking the question, are you interested in teaching? And why that takes investment is because asking the question in an authentic way means providing the right information so people can make an informed decision.
Here with Herman Reeves from Grow Your Own Illinois, this new campaign to try to attract more educators from other careers to consider teaching. What kind of impact have you had over the first year?
The campaign has been proof positive that folks are interested in teaching. I think sometimes we hear the mantra that people don't want to teach. And what our campaign has shown over its life is that's not true. There are people. We have about 2,500 prospective students who signed up and said, tell me more, connect me to one of your partners. I may want to do this. So the interest is out there, and we want to keep providing the information so that we increase that interest in communities that we come to.
As we've covered this issue over the years, there have been surveys of educators who are in the profession, and some have considered leaving the profession, some who already have. I'm sure you've heard their complaints, being underpaid, underappreciated, perhaps being micromanaged by administration, they're not in the classroom. So how do you address sort of those underlying concerns that those who are in the profession aren't staying long enough?
Part of the campaign's work is to highlight the positives of teaching. You just named a lot of stuff that people say about teaching. And on the other side of each of those coins is some positives, too, to say about teaching. So in the campaign, we're focused on showing people a realistic view, but highlighting how teaching can transform their lives and the lives of people in their community. So for the campaign, while we do make sure that folks are aware of the challenges of teaching, we highlight the opportunity that teaching provides. And I think how we as the campaign work on the retention issue, the retention challenge, is through our partnerships with our 22 institutions. We meet with those 22 institutions in a professional learning community monthly. And in those communities, we grapple with a lot of the challenges that these schools face in retaining and recruiting teachers.
It's a societal issue that people simply stay in jobs and careers not as long as they used to. So as more people are leaving education to go to another profession, and likewise you're trying to reverse that, bring some into education from other fields, is it just a reality that people are not going to stay in a career as long as they used to?
Just generally, people are staying in places shorter and shorter, work, life, houses, all of that shorter. And it's happening in teaching too, that teaching is affected by that. And it doesn't change the work.
That's Herman Reeves with Grow Your Own Illinois on efforts to bring more people into the teaching ranks. He spoke with Eric Stock. More to come on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We're still seeing cases of influenza, a new COVID variant, even the measles. All of this comes amid changes in federal vaccine policy. To help us sort through all of it and provide some guidance, we hear from Dr. Emily Landon, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Chicago. She joined WBEZ's Mary Dixon and Sasha Ann Simons to talk more.
One thing I've noticed is so many people we know are calling in sick, and we're sort of, because it's springtime, it's sort of the, is it allergies? Is it a cold? Is it the flu? Is it norovirus? Is it COVID? Do I have to worry about COVID anymore? And then we got the notice from Illinois Department of Public Health that somebody with measles passed through O'Hare and went into, you know, like Niles and Mount Prospect. So I was like, we need to get an expert in here, Dr. Landon.
The list keeps growing. I remember when it was three, it was, is it COVID, RSV, or the flu?
Oh, RSV too.
Remember RSV? But then, yes, as Mary just pointed out, we're confused, doctor.
Well, the good news is I have excellent job security, apparently.
You're not going anywhere anytime soon.
No, there's never a shortage of things that you can pick up in terms of infections from other people. The good news is that most of them are largely, for most people, going to be nuisance infections that make you sick for a few days, and then you'll get better and be back to your life. But yes, you're right. We're still at the tail end of the influenza season. There's some influenza B floating around. We're definitely still seeing a few cases, but fewer than we were last week and fewer the week before that. So it's definitely coming down.
Good.
There's still RSV floating around. They did extend the duration of time that they were providing prophylaxis to newborn infants. And so, but that is also starting to come down. We saw some pretty good decreases. And then we're definitely still seeing COVID. COVID is sort of not settled into a seasonal pattern yet. We definitely see more cases in the winter. But we often see a summer surge of COVID, and you can definitely see cases all year round. Whereas with influenza, once it goes away, it's probably not coming back much until next year. COVID is sort of this ever-present low underlying problem. And then there's always, you know, rhinoenterovirus, regular old coronavirus, which is, I would, you know, non-SARS-CoV coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of other respiratory viruses that I will not burden you with the long names of that circulate at any given time. And the key here is to keep in mind that there are some that are more likely to cause problems for people that have other underlying medical conditions, or even for healthy individuals if you're if you just get unlucky. Okay. And that's the COVID flu and RSV situation. And they're still out there. And that, I think, also means that you have to worry that if you get something that feels like a nuisance virus, it could be dangerous to someone else. And you got to keep that in mind. I think we kind of sometimes lose our way. And we think just because I'm not that sick means everybody else will be not that sick. Or I had a sore throat, so everybody else is just going to have a sore throat. And that's not really how it works.
The cicada variant of COVID.
Yeah. BA.3.2.
That's right.
Talk about long names. Omicron BA.3.2. What is that?
Why are we just starting to hear about it now, those of us who are not doctors?
Well, the reason it's called cicada now is because it actually existed before and it circulated before, and then it didn't really cause much of anything. It sort of was overtaken by a different variant at that time when it first emerged, and then it's now come back. I feel like there's sort of like a, I'm not sure which direction to go with this, because there's always going to be new variants of COVID because that's just how it works. And so we should, to a certain degree, only worry about ones that are going to be definitely worse. And this one isn't worse. It's basically the same as what the other ones have been. It will cause disease in people that had other variants, because the reason these variants emerge is because they accumulate mutations that allow you to still get sick even if you've had a previous version of COVID. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, kind of like influenza, but not, it's faster and it's more frequent variants come through. So I don't want to overdo our concern about that. But at the same time, these new emerging variants do serve to keep it in the news and keep it something that's in the background, because I think we run the risk, as I heard you mention earlier when I was waiting in the green room, of just kind of forgetting about COVID.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't. Flu, at least, it comes every year and it's very predictable. I start getting requests to start coming in and talking on the radio and talk to newspapers about flu every year in December, and the flu shots come out, and it's kind of like, this is when we ramp up for flu. But COVID kind of always has to stay on that vigilant side, and that's hard. That's hard for people to do.
Well, with this cicada variant, I mean, you mentioned the mutations, right? This one's got kind of
75 or
what
something.
What sets it apart is it's got a lot of mutations that, what I hear, it may cause it to look different to your immune system. So yep. Is that something that we should...
Every variant's going to be like that.
...worry about? Okay.
Yeah, so every variant, the reason that these variants arise is because they accumulate enough mutations that our previous immunity isn't going to protect us anymore.
Oh, okay.
So that's the only reason they show up. So every single time there's a new variant, it's going to be like, oh, it has 75 or 70 or 60 or 90 new mutations that make it able to evade your immune system. Now, that's not to say that you're completely not immune to it. It's just saying that you can still get sick even though you've had a related variant before. The bottom line is, we're never going to be completely free of COVID. We're never going to be so immune to COVID that it's not going to be able to mutate and create new disease in people that had it last year or 2 years ago.
This was big news. The Trump administration picked Dr. Erica Schwartz, who has a medical degree from Brown, a master's in public health, and a vaccine supporter, to become director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. As I understand it, a previous nominee was not getting through Senate confirmation because they were skeptical of vaccines. Now we have someone who has served under President Trump before, was the chief medical officer for the Coast Guard, has conventional credentials for someone who would be in charge of the CDC. Can you comment on that, Dr. Landon?
Yeah, I don't know her personally, but I looked at her sort of background today, mm-hmm. and she worked in the public health service, the public health corps, for many years, mm-hmm. and seems to have been an architect of some plans for responsiveness to pandemics, and seems to have some experience that would put her in the realm of being qualified to work for the CDC, which I think is really promising, because the bar has been set pretty low from previous nominees from this administration.
Yeah, isn't that what I said this morning when
yes,
we were talking,
exactly.
Mary? That's exactly it. I agree with you. The bar has just been set so low. So yeah. We're like, wow.
Yeah, exactly.
A human being who cares about public health.
Yeah, she seems to. And I think that's great. So I think that's really good. And I want to say a word about vaccine skepticism here, because I want to be clear that all scientists are skeptical of everything, right? Mm-hmm. We want to balance our analysis of the risks and the benefits of every medication, including vaccines. And so I sometimes bristle at the idea of being a vaccine skeptic, because I want to be a skeptic. I need to be a little bit of a skeptic in order to say this is a good idea for you. You need me to be that kind of skeptic.
That is the scientific method.
But the problem is when we go so far into skepticism that it's actually our ideology becomes skepticism. And instead of it being based on science and evidence, we hew to this belief that vaccines are somehow more dangerous and not as needed as they are. That is an ideology problem, not a science problem. Mm. And I think it's really important to separate the two. And when we use a science word to describe an ideology problem, it sort of makes it sound sciencey.
Okay.
But yeah. I mean, I don't have a problem with it. I just want to make sure that we clarify that, like, sure, there's a healthy amount of skepticism in every scientist. We're not believing in vaccines because we believe in, like, the way somebody might believe in ghosts,
yes,
right? Like, we believe in vaccines because the evidence shows us that they're the right thing to do for the vast majority of people. And skeptics, I think what we consider vaccine skeptics, have a tendency to sort of overvalue negative evidence and fail to really take into account the benefit of vaccines.
Right. And our health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.,
right,
who, as a lawyer, has sued vaccine makers and has made money, that is part of his living, is suing over the, you know, quote unquote, effects of vaccines. Even this week, he testified on Capitol Hill that the measles vaccine is safe and effective, in his words, for most people, and agreed that it was safer than getting measles. It does seem that there is some retrenchment here on the part of Health Secretary Kennedy, that while he started off being not so much skeptical as dismissive of vaccine science, and now it seems with this appointment for the or nomination for the CDC director,
yeah,
and this testimony, you know, where before he was saying you should do your own research for what to do with your baby, now he's saying, well, yeah, this measles vaccine is safe and effective. Can you comment on that, Dr. Landon?
First of all, measles vaccine is safe and effective and recommended for every child except those that have a contraindication to the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, and everyone should get 2 doses of it. Measles is really dangerous.
Yeah.
Really dangerous.
And I don't know that everybody knows what measles actually looks like. So can you clear that up,
yeah,
too? Like, it's a rash, right?
Well,
but
no.
What else?
I mean, it's the rash is the part that you see and that people think of as measles, but
yeah,
what happens inside is far worse. So it's a pretty significant virus that causes, first of all, immune dysregulation. It causes a high, high fever on the order of 103, 104, 105, mm-hmm, especially in children,
wow,
very high, and then causes a rash 4 days in. It also can cause irritation to the eyes and coughing and sneezing and that sort of thing that we call coryza and conjunctivitis. But that's, you know, those are fancy words for feeling like you have a cold. And also this rash is sort of the part that is a hallmark of measles, but it doesn't come until 4 days in. And you've been contagious for a while before, mm-hmm, that. And the problem is that it then can attack a lot of your internal organs. It causes pneumonia. That's how it spreads. And so everyone gets a viral pneumonia, a small pneumonia. Some people, many children, in fact, a pretty high proportion of them end up with complications of measles. About 1 in 5 may need hospitalization. That's a lot. And 1 in 4 to 500 might die. And so it can cause a real disruption to the body in a way that a regular cold or a flu doesn't. And while some children will recover, many will have complications that require additional problems. But then there's the aftermath. And the aftermath of measles is pretty awful.
Mm.
First, it causes what's called immune amnesia, which means you forget, your immune system forgets other things that it's been exposed to.
Oh.
And so for a period of time after having measles, you're at very high risk for getting other problems. These kids often get really significant, maybe deadly ear infections or skin infections or other problems after having had measles, even though they had a healthy immune system before. Measles, like, basically kills off a big chunk of your immune system. And that's awful. Nobody wants that. But then in a very small subset of patients, it can sort of get settled in the brain and not really get removed. And it can cause this longer-term encephalitis called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. And that is a very long term that means about 8 to 10 years after having had measles, a very small, very rare, but still not zero, definitely not zero, number of children who had measles will die of encephalitis. And there's no treatment for that and nothing that we can do and no real survivors of that.
Hmm. It is bizarre to me that from the time of my birth until a few years ago, we thought we had eradicated measles because we had this vaccine.
We did.
And now, you know, for us to see in the news last week, somebody came through Terminal 5 at O'Hare and went to a couple of spots in Niles and Mount Prospect. And that's how carefully they need to track this person who may have exposed, because measles sticks around, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, if you are on the side of pathogens, measles is a winner. Okay. It has got a lot of things going for it. It can spread incredibly easily. It's very light and stays in the air for up to 2 hours after the person with measles leaves the room.
Oh, my
God.
So,
you take an elevator. There's an old study that shows that people were still getting measles riding in an elevator that someone with measles rode in 2 hours before.
Oh, that's
how insane. How not fair is that? Yeah. Like, it is not playing by the rules. It's got some sort of advantage that the rest of us don't have. We have the vaccine. That's what we do have. And so we should use it. But the details of that, I'm going to just say them because I think it's an important public health message. I've actually written them down here and brought them with me. So this individual is in O'Hare Terminal 5 on the 24th between 10:45 and 2:30 p.m. And then they were at Fresh Farms in Niles on the 26th of April from 7:30 to 9, and the Marshalls in Niles from 8 to 9:30.
Is this March, or you're saying the 24th, and it's only the 17th
now? Oh, I'm
now.
Sorry. Okay. Yes, it was March. Okay. I've just written the wrong numbers, the wrong number on my thing, but yes.
It was late last month, yeah. So as long as we're getting
Thank
it out
you for
there,
correcting me.
No, because, you know, that would be time travel, and that would be a completely different show.
Yeah, you know, I'm not opposed to that show, but that's not what we're doing today. Yes, and then Mount Prospect Endeavor Health Immediate Care, they went there. And this is actually a real problem with measles, is that people often come to physicians when they're real sick. You know, you've got a temperature of 105, you're starting to get a rash. You may not have the rash yet. You may not realize you have measles and you're real sick. These kids are really sick and their parents get worried and they bring them to the doctor, to an immediate care or an ER. And they are triaged because we haven't seen measles very much in this, especially this part of the world, the country. We then just put them in the waiting room because we don't realize that they probably have measles, and then a ton more people can be exposed.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, the symptoms take anywhere from 7 to 21 days to actually show up. So it takes a while for you to even know that you have this. So,
yeah, that's right. And so clearly traveled internationally because of the Terminal 5. And so, and that can be a higher risk. Although there are plenty of places in the United States where you can get measles pretty easily nowadays because the vaccine levels have fallen off. It's important to note that babies, small babies, under the age of 12 months, usually have not been vaccinated for measles. And there are also individuals with immunocompromising conditions that can't be vaccinated for measles. And so they are at risk of measles regardless, and they are also the highest risk for measles. And so just because, you know, you think, oh, well, if somebody wants to be protected, they can get themselves the vaccine. Not everybody can do that.
Right.
And we have to live in this world together.
Right. I have a question as an elder. I probably got my measles shot in 1966, so I'm a little concerned that maybe it hasn't lasted till today.
Do you need to re-up?
Yeah, what do I need to know about that, Dr. Landon?
That's a great question. So measles vaccine actually lasts really well if you got two doses of the live vaccine, which probably started in the early 1980s. So if you were born before that, you may have gotten, in the 60s, you may have gotten a killed vaccine, which may not be super effective. Those individuals, it's recommended, if you didn't have actual measles, but you got vaccinated with in the 60s, you probably do need to have a titer drawn and check to see if you have measles, or you could just skip the blood drawing process and just go ahead and get two doses of MMR. It's completely fine. I had measles vaccine MMR when I was a child in the 70s, and I know now I've aged myself.
Yeah, I got it in the 80s.
I mean, I'm right here, so yes. You're good.
In the 70s. And then I had to have titers drawn when I started my work in medicine, much, much later, obviously. And my titers were negative. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have any immunity to measles, but it is an indication that we might as well just top you up. And so I got two more doses of measles.
Okay.
And you're
perfectly safe. I am so protected now. But that's not uncommon. And so those are things to think about. If you were born before the measles vaccine and you had measles as a child, you're good.
Okay. So that is good to know. I will definitely be talking to my doctor about that in the next.
You probably have some residual protection.
We'll have more from Dr. Emily Landon. That's ahead on Statewide. And we're back on Statewide. We now continue our conversation with the infectious disease specialist, Dr. Emily Landon.
Why don't we get some questions from Becky? Becky, what are your questions for Dr. Landon?
My questions, first of all, thank you for being here and talking about these things. I'm really happy about that.
Good.
My question regarding the more recent COVID strains that are developing, has there been any testing to verify that the over-the-counter home tests still detect the newer strains effectively?
Okay, why don't we pause there, Becky? What's the
answer? That's an easy one, Becky. Those tests are pretty good. They are tested for most of the strains, and they hold up really well because they actually are looking for an antigen that is a more conserved part of the COVID virus, not a part that changes because it's not really related to our immunity. If that's sort of a more detailed response than you need, yes, they should work. But it's important to remember those home COVID tests do have limitations, the same limitations they've had since the very first day they came out. And those limitations are that if you test too early, you might not have enough antigen to make the test positive. And that's why they recommend that you repeat it in 48 hours if it was negative. That's why they come in packs of two. It's not so that you can test your family member when they get sick a few days later. It's because you need to retest if you were negative.
Ah, okay. And Becky, what's your other question for Dr. Landon?
The other question was, given that we are seeing more COVID infections and these newer strains, is there any advice about whether those of us who get our shot, you know, religiously every fall should consider getting another vaccine later in the season? Or is that still dependent upon other factors?
Yeah, this is a tricky question. So our vaccine policy about COVID is fraught with political influence and ideology. And I think the science shows us that COVID vaccines, similar to influenza vaccines, and probably similar to other respiratory virus vaccines if we made them, really only are super effective in the first 12 weeks or so, 3 months or so after you get them. But they provide some long-lasting protection against bad complications. So there's two pieces of the vaccine. One is keeping you from getting sick, and the other is keeping you from having complications. So if your goal with the vaccine, and honestly, the goal with all respiratory virus vaccines is to prevent complications more than it is to keep you from getting sick. I wish that we could make them so that they kept you from getting sick, but that's not how respiratory viruses work, and you need immunity in your nose, and that's not how they work, and it's complicated vaccine science. But the bottom line is that there's nothing to say that you shouldn't get additional vaccines. In fact, for some of us recommend every 6 month vaccines for immunocompromised individuals, but I still recommend that we time those as best we can with the new peaks. So as we're seeing a new variant come in that's really starting to peak or like on its way up, then that's a good time. Like right at the very beginning of that is a good time. And so you might be tempted, if you've heard me say this before, to think that this cicada means I probably should, you know, it's the beginning. I don't think that's the case here. We're not seeing big increases. It's been kind of lingering for a few weeks to a month already, and we're not seeing a big sort of exponential rise in cases. And so I don't think that this is the moment, but I think you should sit tight and see what starts to peak over the summer. And if you start hearing about exponential rise in cases, the very beginning, because those cases are always behind what's actually happening on the way up.
Okay.
That's when you probably want to get a second dose, especially if you're immunocompromised. But if you're even a healthy older person doesn't need a second dose.
Okay. So you keep your ears open in the summer and you can be on that fall flu and COVID shot.
Yeah, plan. That's probably fine. If you want a simple way of doing things, the fall flu and COVID combo is probably a good way to go.
That's kind of what I've been coasting on. Yeah. So okay. Thank you for the calls, Becky. We're going to take some more questions for Dr. Landon. So let's get a question in from Todd. Todd, what's your question for Dr. Landon?
Hi, Todd.
Hi. Well, I just wondered why one thing that seldom seems to be mentioned is what's got to be one of the major causes of vaccine failure, which is overlapping the vaccine with painkillers or anti-inflammatory medications. That doesn't seem to get mentioned. There was an article a few years back in the New York Times science section that an advisory had gone out from pediatricians and parents not to medicate their kids shot always because inflammation was necessary to educate the immune system. So I just wonder why that never gets mentioned.
Okay, yeah. Dr. Landon, what about that?
Todd, you're right. There is some data that suggests that sort of pre-medicating children with Tylenol or especially anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen and stuff like that can reduce the effectiveness of at least the COVID vaccine. And I'm not sure. I suspect there's probably data for other vaccines. But what there isn't data for, or what the data don't show, is that it's totally safe to take those after the vaccine because the inflammation has gotten started and the process has gotten started, and you really just need to kick that off. And I don't think I would refer to it as a major cause of vaccine failure. I think it's more likely reducing the effectiveness. And so my recommendation to my patients is not to take any ibuprofen or Tylenol before they get the shot, but if they get symptoms after they've gotten a shot, especially this also happens with Shingrix, although I don't think I've seen a paper about vaccine effectiveness being affected by pre-medication before a Shingrix vaccine. That's the shingles vaccine.
So that's the double shot for shingles for adults.
That's right. People often feel kind of yucky after they've gotten their Shingrix, but it's totally worth it because nothing is yuckier than actual shingles, just for the record.
Right.
And true. The shots are tough.
They are. Yeah. But the shingles is worse. Far worse.
I had to get the varicella I had to do because I never had chicken pox.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. So everyone looks at me strange like, oh, could she potentially get it now?
Yeah, no, you don't want that.
Is she going to spread it to me?
If you had Varivax, you're good.
Yeah, I had Varivax.
Good.
So, so I would say that I would caution against pre-medicating, but I think if you've got symptoms after the vaccine, it's really okay to do that. There's not been anything that suggests that that's going to really make a significant difference in your overall immune response to that vaccine.
Okay, good question, Todd. Thank you. Let's get a question in from Ariel.
Yeah, my question is about masking and how effective that is with measles, especially since it sticks around longer and it's lighter. I'm wondering if it's as effective against measles as it is COVID.
Excellent question. And I love nothing more than to get to talk about the effectiveness of masks.
Okay.
Masks are wonderful, but there are lots of different masks and there are lots of different reasons to wear masks. So masks can be used to sort of keep viral particles from spreading from a person who's sick, and they can also be used to protect you from viral particles that may be in the air. But we sort of have to think about it as it's a lot easier to stop the viral particles from getting out of a person than it is to keep them from getting into you. Mm. And so you always have to use a slightly higher protective mask when you're protecting yourself than when you're trying to keep the viral particles like sort of limited to the individual that's sick. And so when it comes to measles, you really need an excellent mask for both. It turns out that measles is so tricky. It's the most infectious disease known to man. It has the highest R-naught, or like number of people that are infected when, you know, one person is able to infect more people with measles than any other disease if they're, you know, not immune. And so really in the hospital, for example, we have to mask the individual that has measles, and we recommend actually putting an N95 on them, even though they haven't been tested for the fit testing, because it's more effective than just putting a surgical mask on them whenever possible. Although small children and babies, obviously, we don't have N95s for them. Mm. And so that is something we do. But we also mask the providers and the other individuals with N95s. We don't consider you protected if you only wore a surgical mask around a patient with measles. So if you're trying to protect yourself from measles, you're much better off getting a vaccine, because the amount of diligence that you would need to, and I mean, I think healthcare workers should also wear masks around people that they know have measles. But in the general population, using masks as an effective way of preventing the spread of measles is going to be tricky. Like, you don't know where those people are. You don't know that they were there. And it's really hard to wear an N95 24/7 all the time and not ever have to scratch your nose or take a drink from something or have to adjust your mask. And that can be, you know, measles is awful. So, you know, in healthcare, we're going to, you know, go in. We are like, it's like you're standing outside the room, the negative pressure room, you know, the AIIR, the fancy room we put the patients with measles in. And you're like, I'm ready to go. And I'm going to get all ready to go. I'm going to wear my mask. I'm going to go in. I'm going to put it on. I'm going to, it's going to be perfect. I'm going to go in that room. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And then I'm going to come out. I'm going to take it off and switch to, like, if you, you know, depending on the situation, you switch to another mask or no mask. Right. And so it's a little different than trying to use them all the time for protection. And that's what a lot of doctors really sort of bristled against the use of masks in the general public during COVID, because they thought, well, we wear them kind of differently than that.
Right.
And it turns out that matters, right? It's a harder to use them as protection, but that doesn't mean that they don't protect you. So if you are immunocompromised and unable to be immunized against measles for whatever reason, then absolutely wearing an N95 mask when you're out and about, especially if you're in a place where there's low measles vaccine uptake, you're safer with that than you are without.
Let's take one more question from Rebecca. What's your question for Dr. Landon?
Hi. I had long COVID for about 3 to 4 years. Oh, I'd gotten so COVID in November of 2020. Thank you. Before the vaccines came out. So I think I'm mostly over it. But my question is whether any recent research shows if having had long COVID either makes your chances of getting a new variant better or worse, or whether the symptoms would be better or potentially more intense or less. So if you had had COVID.
I wish that COVID. I had a better answer to your question than I do. There's a trickle of evidence about long COVID that sort of is trickling in, but a lot of studies on long COVID were canceled by this administration. A lot of studies on COVID, period, were canceled by this administration. And the data that we're getting are not really going to answer the question for you. They're telling us about, so first of all, individuals who got long COVID, a lot of people got long COVID, but it wasn't very bad. Like, it wasn't super long. They just were sluggish or, you know, a little brain fog for a couple months. That's different than people who were really bedridden for a long time. And it sounds like you really suffered. And so you're an outlier to begin with. Right.
Yeah.
And that means that it's difficult to know. It's really difficult to study outliers because outliers as a group are all they're all outliers to begin with. And so it's very difficult to understand if what works for 70 or 60% of people that were similar to you. But we also know that long COVID is probably a collection of 6 or 7 different things. Right. Or 6 or 7 different groups of symptoms, and we're not 100% certain about how any of that worked. And so it can be really difficult to extrapolate anything. I would say that your best, you should avoid getting, I mean, my advice to people who've had long COVID, I can't give you medical advice over the radio, but my advice to people who've had long COVID is to avoid getting COVID. Okay. And if you think you can tolerate, you know, you need to have a conversation with your physician about the vaccine and about your own protection, but it didn't work once, I wouldn't go.
That's Dr. Emily Landon, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Chicago, and she spoke with Mary Dixon and Sasha Ann Simons. Illinois could have a new alternative to burial and cremation. Legislation that passed the Illinois House could add human composting as an option for dealing with remains. The bill would create natural organic reduction facilities, which would turn bodies into nutrient-rich soil over a 30 to 45-day decomposition process. The bill's sponsor is the Democratic Representative Mary Beth Canty from Arlington Heights. She says it presents a carbon-neutral option for disposing of human remains.
End-of-life planning is a deeply personal process, and the loss of a family member initiates a series of immensely difficult decisions. Individuals and families need access to safe and cost-effective burial options that meet their needs.
That bill now in the state Senate. State lawmakers want to add Latin American studies to public school curriculums. Isabella Nieto brings us more on that.
The legislation would require every public elementary and high school to teach students about the social, political, and economic contributions of Latin Americans. An early version of the bill allowed disciplinary action against schools that don't comply with teaching Latine studies, but that provision was removed. Here's the bill's sponsor, Democratic Representative Evadina Delgado of Chicago.
This curriculum exists. It's just a matter of sharing it between the school districts. Lots of work has been done on it.
Republicans opposed the bill, saying it's adding mandates for schools that are already stretched thin. The bill is now moving through the Senate. I'm Isabella Nieto.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being with us, and join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.